everyone, and welcome to another brand new spoiler review episode for Shogun. We're talking about episode 6 today here on the Outlaw Nation. I am the Outlaw John Roker, joined as always by my Hamamoto himself, Steve Morris. How are you, Steve?
Konbonwa, Roko-san. It is a pleasure to see you.
Oh, great. Okay. I didn't know what that means, but yes, I like it.
I believe it was good afternoon, but I'm not 100%. Konnichiwa is definitely good morning. I think yes. Konbonwa is good afternoon. So maybe I got that right. Maybe I didn't. If you wanted words for like joint locks or hip throws, I have a bunch of those. but other than that, my Japanese is fairly weak.
Yeah. As much as I've watched so many Japanese movies over the years, I have never sat down to learn it because everyone says how difficult that language is to learn. But I think after watching this show, Steve, I'm even more motivated to learn the language because, I mean, I don't mind reading subtitles, but it'd be nice to kind of just kind of listen and see if I can figure it out before I read the subtitles, which would be fun. But totally. That's neither here nor there. We're here to talk about episode 6, Ladies of the Willow World. This is a spoiler review. Before we go one step further, just letting you know, this is a spoiler review. So if you haven't seen the episode, please stop now, go and watch it and come back and pick up where you left off. Or if you don't care, keep watching, or if you watch the episode, keep watching, because we are absolutely going to spoil it and have a big old discussion about this episode. And the way I pitched it to Steve and the way we're going to do it here is we're going to separate this review into two massive blocks, which is one block is going to be dealing with Lady Ochiba and all the things that she is doing throughout the episode. So we're going to go out of order as how you see things in the episode. So we're going to take a break, and then the other block will be dealing with Toronaga and Blackthorn and Mariko and everyone involved there in what's going on there with their plannings as well for war that we get by the end of the episode. But Steve, I like to start off this way right off the bat. Interesting episode. Again, a lot of political pieces. This was very, I know people have compared this to Game of Thrones, but for me, this is the most Game of Thrones-ish episode of the entire season, complete with brothels, complete with political machinations, complete with backstabbing, complete with people whispering in other people's ears, causing them to do certain things, and all of this lead, and then one person resisting being in power and then grabbing power by, or trying to grab power by the end. So your thoughts overall on this episode here as we get, we're on the precipice of the last two episodes here to wrap up the season. What are your thoughts on this one?
So I had a strange thought as I was watching this time, is that my brain kept going back, and I know this is going to sound crazy, but to the Harry Potter movies. And here's what I mean, which is that the first, you know, I read those books many times. I had real love for the books. When the first movie came out, it was very clear that Chris Columbus tried to exactly do what was in the book.
Yeah.
And there's something a little bit stale about that movie. Even though those things that were in the book were great in the book, it felt as if there wasn't his own creative vision. And the best of the Harry Potter movies is the one that maybe diverged the most from the book, and that's the third one, which is really, really good, where you have the sense of a real artist coming in and loving the source material, but then applying his own artistry to the source material. Right. And I think this is much more like the latter. And I think when we started off, it was closer to the book. And then as we went getting into the last episode and then this episode, there's some real divergences. And the biggest divergence we'll get in as we go into it is, as I've said many times, there's more conflict between Mariko and Blackthorn. Because they've established it from that first time that she translated and saw the priest, and then each of these little steps where there's falling outs, those don't happen in the book.
Yeah.
And what's so interesting, and this is just how art and how filmmaking works, is that you make a choice.
Yeah.
And the choice is to have more conflict. And then that leads to consequences. And therefore, you have to go in slightly different directions. Mm-hmm. And one of them is, for me, the greatest scene in this episode is unquestionably because of how they set up those characters in a slightly different way from in the original. So, like, you know, I have the two brains in my head, which is one loving the things that were like they were in the book and then adapting to the, but that's not what this is. This is its own work of art going in its own way. And it has to be at a certain point. You can't make a film like I think Chris Columbus tried to do in that first Harry Potter movie of just, I'm just going to copy what's the book. You have to add to it with your own vision and your own approach to these things, because this is a movie, this isn't a book, and I really like some of the choices they're making in that way.
I thoroughly enjoyed this episode because we got to really sink into more of Lady Ochiba's backstory and what went on there, and add an element of tragedy here, because clearly Lady Ochiba and Lady Mariko were friends and from childhood had this connection. And Mariko, by the time she got to the point where she could be married, and certainly showing her being able to fight and all of that. So we saw that she was being formed into this fighter by her father, so to speak. And later, of course, Toranaga says that he wished that his father had wished, or his, that Mariko's father had wished that Mariko had been a son, because he'd have really been in a position of power, been able to be guided into a position of power. Then again, if Mariko had been a son, he most likely would have been dead. And so it
right, exactly.
So it's the irony of it all. But clearly there is more going on here with Mariko and Ochiba and where this is leading to what we're going to have in terms of the conflict. So I love that they've set that up. So a show that deceptively is about the male characters in Toranaga and Blackthorn, in this episode, it seemed to pop up clearly that this is a battle between Lady Ochiba and Lady Mariko, with Mariko being connected to Toranaga. So in essence, collateral damage in that situation. And I imagine Ishido will eventually be collateral damage for the Lady Ochiba side of things. So I like that all of a sudden this popped up now as kind of the predominant narrative and the reason for why all of this is happening, which I think is a fascinating thing to explore here within this series and this episode for sure. So, all right. So as I said, we're going to break it down into sex. So I'm going to read everything, make it real quick as I can. And then Steve and I are going to dive into all the particulars going on here. And this is, of course, directed by Hiromi Kamata, who I think did a wonderful job in this episode, and written by Megan Huang, who's kind of becoming my favorite writer in the series. So I'm really enjoying what she's able to do here. But as I said, this was a Lady Ochiba heavy episode. We go back 20 years to her and Mariko being introduced to each other as children. Ochiba is the daughter of the warlord Kuroda, and Mariko is the daughter of one of Kuroda's most trusted generals, Akechi Jinsai. And Kuroda is the one who is killed, of course, so the Taiko can take power by Akechi Jinsai. So the two here, Ochiba and Mariko, become best friends, with Ochiba even helping Mariko get ready for her wedding to Buntaro. And we get Mariko, who looks to be, I'm saying that as best, Mariko, looking at the situation as if she's being married down, like she's married down to the Toda clan with Buntaro. She is not happy with the wedding at all. And as I said, as we know, Mariko's father betrays and assassinates Kuroda after marrying her off to Buntaro, which is an important thing that comes up later in this particular episode. Kuroda's death leads to the Taiko's rise to power. Still, we don't really understand the motivations of Mariko's father just yet for doing this, other than the fact that Kuroda was known to, quote, be cruel, which we found out, I think, last episode or two episodes ago. And as for Ochiba, she is later married off to the Taiko, and we see the Taiko's wife prepare her to sleep with the Taiko and bear him an heir. And back in the present day, Lady Ochiba is back in Osaka now and finally ready to move what seems to be her chess pieces here in the council. So she partners up with Ishido and has the Lord of Osaka burn down Toranaga's estate, trap his wives, and replace him on the council with a sympathizer to their cause in Lord Ito. What do you know? An actor and a devout follower of the late Taiko. At Ito's performance, Sugiyama earlier tells Kiyama that this turn marks, quote, the end of the realm, and then later at the Council of Regents refuses to go along with the railroading of Toranaga's impeachment. Then Lady Ochiba, who is clearly not happy, goes to visit Ishido, whispers sweet nothings of death in his ear, calls the council playthings, quote unquote, warns them that they have no idea who they're messing with in terms of the enemy they face in Toranaga, and reveals that she believes the reason there's an issue that she has with Toranaga, which I thought was maybe jilted love or whatever, it's actually that Toranaga, what she believes, Toranaga ordered Mariko's father to assassinate her father, that's Lady Ochiba's father, and she speaks about how she bore the heir to the Taiko by scratching out the eyes of fate, figuratively, of course. And she says, none of you can stop him. And she has clearly positioned herself as the only one who can. So, Steve, I think I did a good job encapsulating that. But your thoughts overall on the Lady Ochiba? Oh, no. I mean, and specifics, of course. What did you think about how Lady Ochiba's character was handled in this episode? How does it differ from the book? And what do you think about the political machinations throughout this episode that she was involved in?
So first of all, you did an excellent job. Second of all, I think that I think I said this last time when we were talking about, you know, Ochiba's the last image of the episode, I think, is her close up. And I went, and you said, is this going to be a big character? And I said, well, she's a great character, but in this really, really big book, she's given importance, but I thought from the last episode, they're going to give her much more importance in this show than really happens in the book.
Right.
And they definitely have. Yeah. I think because, and part of it, I think, is Ishido is not a worthy enemy of Toranaga.
Yeah.
Like, you needed someone to come in like this. And I think, I mean, there are no, in the book, there are no flashbacks to Mariko's childhood that I can remember. They're not, we don't see any of that. One thing I'll disagree with you a little bit is I think her implication about Toranaga, which I love, it's not that he ordered this guy to kill his liege lord. Right. I think he did exactly what Omi did, which is that he manipulated him into thinking it was his own idea, because that's Toranaga style.
Yeah.
You know, and I love the fact that it just in that flashback, we see him, you know.
Can I add something to what you just said, Steve? And you're absolutely right, because Toranaga later says that he prides himself on not launching the first blow, on being the person who reacts to the people who attack him. So, yeah, excellent point.
Yeah, he manipulates people into attacking when he wants them to in his way. One other thing, by the way, that's so interesting, and this is why I love when you learn about a new culture, is that, not that Japan is a new culture, but when you learn about something you didn't know before, is that it's not that unusual that this lord is also an actor. That's actually something that they talk about with Toranaga. Toranaga performs in no drama all the time. It's mentioned many times in the book. And the part of it is that the samurai culture, they also do flower arrangement and tea ceremony and calligraphy. Like, the arts are considered totally appropriate to learning how to be a great warrior and a great lord. That if you ignore the arts, if you ignore your calligraphy or your ability to perform in no drama, and no drama comes up a lot for Toranaga because he's always acting.
Right.
He's always pretending something else. So that's
the point.
Yeah. So it's not actually a weird thing that this lord is performing in this play. I loved the use of the play as a way to give us exposition about who Ōichiba is, what her history is, both through the flashbacks, and we're actually seeing it all. And I love, too, the moment, you know, she's being counseled or persuaded by the nun who is the wife of the widow of the Taiko, and she's pro-Toranaga. And then we see this moment, and it happens real fast, where you see, as they're preparing her to go sleep with the Taiko, that you see an eye hit, because they've eaten, basically they fed her on some kind of herbs.
Yes.
They drugged her essentially in order to help facilitate giving birth. I think, and it's interesting too, because again, this is stuff, it's sort of maybe hinted at a tiny bit of the book, but it's very clear. And this is what you can do in a movie with one image that might take you page after page after page in a book, is that with one or two images, we go, Mariko and Ōichiba, at this time of their childhood, they were best friends.
Yeah.
Like, they, and so the schism that happens, and by the way, the way that they show the craziness of this dictator just hacking off heads, and when she wakes up and he goes, go back to bed, this is just a dream, and you could see the violence happening in the background. I mean, I think that that is all handled so, so well. And the two of them in bed together, as they kind of, they don't turn around and snuggle up, but it's very clear that they needed the closeness of their bodies because of the terrible, terrible things going on just outside their door. Yeah. I thought that was incredible and makes her character, Ōichiba's character, way more interesting. And as you said it perfectly, her whispering into his ear, into Shido's ear, and you just go like, oh, shit, because what they have done is they've created a worthy adversary for Toranaga that we didn't quite, that I don't think it exists in the book. In the book, it's much more, everything's an adversary to Toranaga. He's got to deal with everything. But here it's like, oh, it's all focusing in on one person. And I think that's really strong.
Yeah. For those who don't know, no drama, which Steve keeps mentioning, is NOH. That's no drama. It's a Sino-Japanese word for skill or talent. It is a major form of classical Japanese dance drama that has been performed since the 14th century. So when we see the actor doing those moves, the two actors on stage doing that, and then the guys off stage banging the drums there and adding the music, it's a fascinating thing if you've ever witnessed no drama. But I will say this, Steve, watching this particular episode, and certainly these sections of the episode, I thought to myself, this is like people waking up to Frank Herbert's influence on Star Wars. If you go back and watch Last Samurai, he's essentially copying so much shit of James Clavell's Shogun. And I don't remember seeing any kind of credit from Edward Zwick, the director of Last Samurai, or the writers who wrote Last Samurai, crediting James Clavell's Shogun. And maybe I've missed it. And maybe you all down below can let me know if there's an interview where he does, because a lot of things are similar and a lot of scenes and moments are kind of similar. And you're right about that, because we see that in The Last Samurai, how Ken Watanabe performs in the no drama.
Oh, right.
Also being a samurai, you know, so that, as you said, that is something that was a part of it. And this may be why I love samurai so much, because they mix the warrior with the arts. And that's always been an element of who I am. And it may be why I love them so much and enjoy their dramas and film so much, just kind of like subconsciously. Do you know what I'm saying? And
totally.
Yeah. And so go ahead, Steve. Yeah.
Well, you just made me think of a thing that I just think is important to point out, is that World War II ends in 45. And yes. The image of how Americans felt about the Japanese, particularly when you saw the treatment of prisoners in Southeast Asia, what happened in the Philippines, like there was tremendous anger. The book Shogun comes out in 75. And at that time, is the 70s is sort of the beginning of the economic miracle of Japan, mm-hmm. where suddenly, but when we grew up, when we were kids in the 70s, made in Japan was a joke. You would say something broke down, you go, oh, made in Japan, right. Because they built all these sort of cheaper electronics, cheaper things. And then it's the 80s, by 1980, it suddenly becomes, oh, there's, you know, the Toyotas are coming in and Sony is coming in. And so there's this transformation throughout the 80s in our perception of Japan. And I think the novel and the miniseries, because it's like, you know, Roots, it probably is a bigger miniseries than Shogun, but not by much. Basically, everybody in America watched Shogun.
Yeah.
And the book was one of the biggest sellers in the world. And so the transformation of our image of Japan and who they are, Shogun is a big, big part of it. Yeah. And so I really think, I'm really glad you brought it up, because it's like, oh, this is, you know, of course it's hugely influential.
Yeah.
Absolutely hugely influential.
Yeah. Yeah. You can sense that when you're watching, for sure. Let me ask you this. When you're looking at how she's maneuvering all of these things into place, did you feel that sense of tragedy? Like you said in the book, they don't really do the flashbacks. I'm sure that's like a conversational exposition.
Yeah, you hear little bits about some of the
right. So you have that exposition route. So you're saying you like the way they did it for this particular medium to make it fit within the story they're overall telling here. But do you like that element of tragedy that seems to be the undercurrent here, because they were best friends and this was a split because their parents were involved, or their fathers rather, were involved in this stuff, and where Mariko has found solace in Toranaga's shadow and umbrella, Ochiba has found disdain and hatred for Toranaga, each of them going in their different directions because of what their fathers did. Do you sense that that's an element that we're going to come back to in this particular telling of the story, without revealing any spoilers, I guess, from the book?
I don't really have spoilers, because I would say much of this is not really what's in the book. Wow. I think, you know, like one of the basic, and I've said it before, and it's in the book that I'm writing, but one of my basic rules of storytelling is every scene must have conflict and every scene must have emotion. And if you can't find, and if you think of a way that you can add conflict to a moment, you should do it. And so you go like, would it be better that Ochiba has no feelings about Toranaga and Mariko, or would it be better if she had strong, powerful, profound feelings? Mm. It's always better when someone has strong, powerful, profound feelings. And it's funny, like, I really think, I don't know at this moment how to feel about Ochiba. I know I hate Ishido. That's not a question. But like, we don't really understand what her ultimate goal is, other than that she's against our people. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like,
so the protagonist that we're cheering for. Yes,
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. But so I, and as I've said many, many times to you, I like watching intelligence. And so watching her manipulation and manipulation of Ishido is great. It's fantastic to watch. I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah. Has shades of Shakespeare with Lady Macbeth and all of that.
Absolutely.
That as well. And you can kind of understand, because I suppose if you're a mother watching the show, you're like, I get it. She's trying to do what she can do in a violent society that hides behind its rituals and its manners to protect her son, you know, and of course, as a byproduct, protect her access to power. Right. Yep. Kind of like what you saw in, as we said, Game of Thrones with Joffrey and Cersei, her mom there, his mom right behind him, trying to manipulate him into power and what have you. So I think it's fantastic what Lady Ochiba is doing. And I do want to give credit to the actress Fumi Nikaido. I hope I'm saying that right. I thought she was excellent in this particular episode, as they've given her more real estate to show what she can do. Let me ask you about one more thing before we move off of this particular section and move into the other stuff. Sugiyama is wiped out here by Ishido. Let's talk about that. I mean, he could have killed Sugiyama at any time. Doing it this way and quote unquote blaming it on the bandits, which seems to be the default thing we've seen throughout the series. How much of a massive decision is this by Ishido? Has he really worked this out? And what do you think about Sugiyama saying to him at the end that you're only ever going to be a lifelong bureaucrat, and that's all you're ever going to be, which I think really damaged Ishiro, judging from the expression on the actor's face there. What did you think about his decision? And is this the same in the book? Does he wipe out Sugiyama in the book?
I think my memory in the book is that he tortures him to death and his whole family. I think it's worse. And I think it's worse in the book. I think what's so great. So the prior there was more fluidity in my understanding between the peasant classes and the merchant classes and the samurai classes in earlier eras of Japan. And then, but it wasn't very fluid when the Taiko became the Taiko. He was a peasant and he brought a bunch of people that were not samurai like Ishido with him up into these halls of power. And it seems like Ishido was an excellent administrator of the Taiko's realm. And you know what? We need excellent administrators. 100%. Absolutely. But he's not the genius that Torinaga is. Torinaga is a genius that's similar to the Taiko. And so I think, you know, that's class thing. Like you're always going to be an administrator. That is a sick burn, particularly at the moment of your death. The other thing, and this is what, you know, and it relates to the other half of the block that we're going to get into in a moment, but is that what Blackthorne doesn't understand is how complicated and how necessary these Christian daimos are to Torinaga. Is that this guy, he part of what makes him who he is that he's a Christian. And so the fact that if Blackthorne goes after the Christian, that loses a huge chunk of power within the council. And the fact that Ishido ended up killing Sugiyama is now going to alienate the Christian daimos, you know? And so like understanding how that's why this balance of power on this council is like really, really critical. Yeah. I also go like, if I ever hear that the outlaw was killed by bandits, I am definitely going to look up. I'm not saying it's Mike Vogel that probably made it happen, but I definitely have got to have to check to make sure that everything is okay.
I think you might look at JG over Vogel.
Fair.
Be real. Anyway, well, let's. One last thing before we move on this, because I didn't make a point of this, and it occurred to me as we were talking. The Portuguese priests get the Catholic priests get a few seconds of screen time here. When we hear about Ishido destroying the castle there, or Torinaga's castle, and trapping his wives and burning everything down, your thoughts on this? Where they finally showed up? I feel like we forgot about them for a couple of episodes. So, are they becoming kind of an afterthought? Is that bothering you a little bit, or do you wish we'd had more of them over the last couple of episodes? What are your thoughts here as they have this exchange where it's very clear that the younger priest has an affinity for Torinaga more than the older priest does?
I would say it's exactly the way it is in the book in terms of the ratio is that we're going to check, you know, it's a check-in. We do a little check-in and there, you know, I'd never thought about the association with Game of Thrones and Shogun. It never occurred to me until doing the show with you, but this is the Game of Thrones. You know, this is literally, they are looking at which horse to back. They don't care, you know, like they just want to make sure that they have the power. And Alvito is going, he has a better understanding of Torinaga's character. Like if you're going to pick a person, you would pick Torinaga because Ishido is not that person. Lady Ochiba is super powerful and brilliant, but she's a woman, so can't have that position. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the council, none of them are strong. But if you're going to pick the assets, like who has the advantage in terms of troops, in terms of wealth, in terms of position, Osaka Castle itself is almost impossible. Like one of the big things in the book is that Blackthorne and everyone else looks at Osaka Castle and goes, there's no way anybody could conquer someone in this castle. It's the walls are too thick. The defenses are too brilliant. There's no way to get into this place. And that's one of Ishido's huge advantages. And so you have the older, you know, the head of the Jesuits going, no, are you crazy? We got to stick with Ishido. I mean, that's where all the power is. And Alvito going, no, you should stick with the man. Right. And Torinaga is the person in the long run we can trust.
And that's certainly what's going to come to play here when you talk about attacking the Osaka Castle as we get into this plan apparently called Crimson Sky. So let's take a quick break, though. Before we jump into that, we'll jump into some the rest of the storylines here in this particular episode here right after this.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
You know, John, I don't have to tell you that I had a pretty rough month last month. I had family commitments, work stuff was a bit overwhelming, and frankly, my battery felt drained. And one of the ways that I looked to charge up that battery came through therapy.
Yeah, absolutely. Steve, you and I have both spoken about our therapy journeys. here on the show. Certainly for me, one of the things that got me back in recharged, got me back connected to life, got me back ready to go and take control of my life was therapy. Once you go deep and find out what's going on, it's amazing how much more energetic, how much more you're willing to take part in your life. And therapy helps you do that for sure.
So if you're thinking of starting therapy, I'd give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/cinephiles today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/cinephiles.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
For those of you who are watching, I do that for the podcast feed. We put that up on the Cinephiles podcast feed. I think when we're done recording all these, I'll issue them daily on the Outlaw Nation podcast feed. But for now, if you want to go back and re-listen to our conversation, not necessarily watch us here on YouTube, you can re-listen to it on the Cinephiles podcast feed, Cine-Files. So you can find that wherever you download podcasts. All right, Steve, let's get into it here. Toranaga, Blackthorn, and Mariko, let's move into these things. There's Toranaga handling his business, looking awesome. We also later on see Buntaro and Mariko and Blackthorn doing their thing, and we do focus here on Mariko, what she goes through. So let's get into the specifics of it. Toranaga awards Blackthorn for saving his life here by naming him Chief Admiral of the Kanto region, which you see affects Omi strongly, more strongly than it affects Yabushige. Yabushige scolds him, scolds Omi later about it when Omi's all obsessed about a barbarian, when he's like, we're about to all fucking die. You really give a shit about the barbarian being in charge of what's left of the army? Oh, and by the way, I need to do a new will, which I thought was awesome. Meanwhile, Buntaro, as I just showed you there, apologizes to Toranaga about his behavior and reveals something really interesting about Mariko, Steve. He says, I thought she'd be grateful that I spared her life, but she's always been ice for years. The ice has not melted, but with him, it's different. Even he knows. He can sense that she has feelings for Blackthorn as opposed to feelings for him, which have never been there. For a number of reasons, which we'll find out later, that Mariko was possibly incorrect about. Toranaga orders Buntaro to go on a break for 7 days for Mariko. And then Blackthorn and Mariko showed up, as I just showed you there, guys, about a minute ago. And he wants to know why he's getting everything but his ship. All he wants is his ship. And then Mariko and Blackthorn have a testy back and forth when he talks about the fact that he wants to go after the Catholics and the Portuguese. Toranaga senses that Blackthorn is all wound up and tells Mariko to go set him up for a good pillowing at a brothel there and to join him, quote unquote, as his translator. Again, this manipulative SOB, putting her in that room with him, which I think is so interesting in the way he's doing this. On the way to the brothel, Blackthorn asks Mariko if Toranaga suspects that they spent a night together. She said there's nothing to know. And Lady Kiku, we find out, is Blackthorn's courtesan for the evening. And of course, Lady Kiku is the one who was in love with Lord Omi that we saw a couple of episodes ago. We go through some rituals. And we hear there at the brothel. And before we get to the brothel, there's a fantastic negotiating scene between Kiku and Mariko and Lady Fuji drinking the tea as she reveals the fact that, hey, you could be with this guy if you want to be with this guy. I thought was an incredible moment. When we get to the brothel or to the tea house, sorry, we go through some rituals and hear about the Willow World, hence the title of the episode. Kiku suggests that Mariko really dark so she can't see. And then they deliver this incredibly sensual speech here, Steve, where I thought, let me see the director again, Hiromi Kamata, genius to move the camera around so that you see Mariko speaking the words, translating them, but you don't see Lady Kiku saying the words so that you're caught up in the fact that Blackthorn is becoming obsessed with her and the way he shoots her in close up in certain sections of her face. All of it adds the sensuality of it all. And then she says that Mariko can come join them. Mariko declines. The next morning, it seems as if Blackthorne had a great time, much to Omi's chagrin and Mariko's quiet displeasure. I thought Anna Sawai did a great job with this eightfold fence moments when she's slowly letting certain things out to show in her face, which I thought was great. They immediately move on talking about Ochiba and why a woman would war against them with such conviction. Oh, sorry, jumped there. Sorry. Mariko, Mariko must report to Tornaga about what happened and tells him that Blackthorne was pleased. Tornaga moves on talking about Ochiba and why a woman would war against them with such conviction. And Mariko, which is a nice gender politics moment, reminds him that it's that, yeah, because you're a man, you don't understand. It sucks to be a woman in 17th century Japan. I mean, do you want me to tell you what you made me do last night? But then Tornaga reveals that Mariko's father married her off in that manner because he knew that he was going to kill the previous lord and wanted to protect her so she'd come back to finish the job. And this, you can see, changes Mariko fundamentally. She thinks she has let her father down, but Tornaga says, your war is not over. And then later, Tornaga is having this incredibly interesting council scene where this top secret plan called Crimson Sky is laid out, which is a single all-out attack on Osaka Castle designed to simultaneously wipe out his enemies and institute a new government with Tornaga as its head. And his son whispers, Shogun, in awe-struck delight. Later, Tornaga hears the news about Sugiyama and is finally urged to declare Crimson Sky, and it's a battle plan for war. And that is what is going to happen. Of course, we end on Lady Ochiba's face, but the end of Torunaga's part in this episode is him standing in front of his troops and saying they're going to war with that war chant. Crimson Sky, it will be. So, Steve, your thoughts here on Blackthorne and Mariko, Lady Kiku's involvement in the tea house section of this, and also Torunaga's machinations and movements here to put him in this position to say, hey, I don't want to be shogun. But he did this. He killed Sugiyama. So, all right, I'll go be shogun.
Well, I don't think he said, actually, I'll go be shogun. He continually has said, I don't want that. He says, I don't want that. I mean, to be clear, spoiler alert, Tokugawa, who Torunaga is based on, becomes shogun in 1600 in Japan after the Battle of Sekigahara.
And this is called shogun. So, yeah.
I mean... Just saying. I would say the biggest general difference between this and the book is that in the book, every single character that you have mentioned is playing their cards much, much closer to the vest.
Oh, interesting.
Everything is subtler. Everything, like the first of all, the knowledge of Mariko's attraction to Blackthorne, it's like everybody, Buntaro is looking at it and getting it, Torunaga's getting it. It's much, much turned down, I would say,
in the show. In the show?
In the book. It's much more turned down. Okay. Everything is subtler, okay. I would say. Omi in particular, it becomes very clear around this time in the book that he's in love with Kiku. But yeah. It is much, much, much less visible because you can't, there's just so many of the societal norms won't allow you to do that. And so it's more about looks and thoughts than it is about overt things, I would say.
Yeah.
I think Buntaro says it all on the nose when he's speaking to Torunaga. It's much less in the book. But okay. I will say, the moment of him standing up and turning around and they're there, that is a great moment. And it's so, bringing up that image, I mean, that is a look of death going on right there.
Yeah.
I think, and because it's all a little bit more overt, the suspicions are a little bit more on the surface. It does certainly, going back to my original rule, this makes it all much more dramatic. It definitely is. The scene with Kiku, I think it's totally different from what's in the book.
Oh,
and it is amazing. I think, and this is where, so when I was saying, if you make certain choices, those lead you to a different place. We end up in a different place at the scene from Kiku from what it is in the book.
Can I ask real quick to clarify? Do you mean the Kiku negotiating scene, or do you mean the
No. Well, it's not Kiku negotiating. It's the Mama-san who's negotiating.
Oh, sorry, the Mama-san. Yeah, Mama-san is negotiating. Sorry.
But that scene's fantastic, and that scene is very much, I love both of them getting the upper hand at different sort of moments, and all the subtle and the turning of the teacup and all of those. all that stuff. Love it. It was all done great. And she and the Mama San's a great character, and I'm glad that there were. I'm sure we will see more of her in the future. No, yeah. I mean the scene in the actual brothel.
Okay.
So let me tell you what I'll tell you what the scene is much more like in the book.
Okay.
In the book, so in this point in the show, there's a lot of conflict between them. You know, we've just had the scene where in the previous episode where there's kind of a break between them and I'm just going to be your interpreter. And then there's the, well, if you're just my interpreter, why don't you interpret? Like all that stuff. The conflict is pretty high. And it is definitely, definitely not Torunaga who says you have to be in there with him.
Oh,
that is not what happens. What happens is that Kiku goes in with her because she and Blackthorn have kind of professed their affection for each other openly many times. And so,
oh, wow.
And so it's they're in a much more romantic place when this scene happens. And then and Blackthorn's Japanese is much, much, much better. And so the thing that they're talking about is she's going, the thing you could do to make me most proud is to treat this whole evening like you're Japanese. And he's like, OK, I'm going to do my best to be Japanese about this whole thing. They go in and Mariko says to him, listen, in our world, if a woman has feelings for a man, but she can't act on them, sometimes she might give him a very special gift of an evening that where she can't be there, but someone else can be there in her stead.
Wow.
And so you remember when I said at the very beginning how I loved James Clavell in high school and in college, and then somewhere in my 20s or 30s, I started thinking about the way that Asians and the Japanese, and in particular Asian women, are exoticized by the white guy writing these books. This is a perfect example. The idea when I was 17 that there could be this beautiful woman who's in love with you and the culture is so open that because she can't have sex with you, she's going to bring you to the most incredibly talented courtesan to have sex with you for her. It's like, wow, this Japanese culture sounds great. And looking at it as a 25-year-old or a 35-year-old person, I was like, yeah, okay. And then the scene with it's not a heavy, serious scene. Yeah. It's they bring out sex toys and they're giggling about it. And Kiku does impressions and they have a blast. Right. They have a lot of fun. And then Mariko goes, hey, I'm going to go. Please remember, I want you to treat tonight like you're Japanese. And he goes, I'll do my best. And goes off to have sex with Kiku. And all that's great. This is a totally different scene.
Yeah.
And it's a totally different scene because of the setup. Yeah. Because they're in conflict and they're not that happy with each other, it's much sadder and heavier because Torunaga sent her there on purpose. And you go, dude, what is up? You know, and it's because things are more overt. If things are more subtle, then it doesn't connect as much when Torunaga sends her. But when he's just had the scene with Buntaro, he knows about all the conflict. He obviously can tell they're in love with each other. And he purposely sends her into a brothel with the guy. It's like he's messing with. I mean, that's much bigger. And then the moment and Kiku is a brilliant character. And even though she does completely different things in this scene.
Yeah.
The choice to stand up, walk around to Mariko's side and kneel perfectly behind her so that it's going to appear that the words are coming out of her mouth.
Yeah.
And then she gives this speech that relates so perfectly to Mariko's feelings. And so Mariko is forced to say these words that expose her own feelings and desire directly to the I was like, that is more brilliant. That is the most brilliant conceptual idea of the whole series, as far as I'm concerned. I thought that was amazing.
Yeah, it stood out to me for sure. But as you said, the setup here is really interesting, Steve. So let's remove what you remember from the book. What do you think about the setup here? Because what is Torunaga's end goal here? As you've already laid out and as we've seen already through the first six episodes, including this one, he clearly has multiple moves that he is constantly multiple chess pieces in play consistently all the time. Sending Mariko with a Blackthorn in the context of this particular adaptation of the book is a fascinating decision because is he trying to expose her to her feelings and make it real? Is he trying to torture her in some way? Is he trying to shame her into not having these feelings for Blackthorn? Or is he trying to find out for sure if she has feelings for Blackthorn and then maybe will facilitate the divorce? Because remember, he's the one that says to Buntaro in their interaction earlier in the episode, divorce her then, man, if you have a problem with her. But Buntaro doesn't want to do it. He can't do it. He loses himself when he gets around her, he says. So clearly his love for her is very intense. And so I wonder if Torunaga is maybe manipulating the situation to put her in this position on purpose
to maybe use that allegiance with Blackthorne to manipulate Blackthorne down the road for his own needs. So as much as I don't want to see him as necessarily a bad guy, there are a lot of manipulations going on Torunaga's side. What did you think about that decision to have, as you said, it's not in the book, but send her to be a part of this?
So after careful analysis of all of these episodes, can I give you my well thought out opinion on exactly why Torunaga is doing this?
I love the setup. I know where you're going, but please tell me.
I have no idea.
Yeah, exactly.
I have no idea.
Well, which is great, because you're a book reader, right?
Yeah. Well, and this is the thing. When you read the book or watch the movie the first time, you watch The Sting the first time, you watch Ocean's 11 the first time, and you go like, why are they getting that thing? Why are they practicing that thing? Why are you? And then when the reveal happens and you see why, it's great.
Yeah.
I've read the book many, many times. I can go back as I'm reading it and know why Torunaga is doing what he's doing. Right. We've left the book. I have no idea why Torunaga said it. It seems to be like it's only going to create conflict. Like you're only going to set up more problems for them, more conflict with Buntaro. Like I can't say like, oh, he really cares about Mariko's feelings and he wants her and the Anjin-san to be happy. I don't think that's what's going on at all. Because the reality is Torunaga is a genius. But whether or not the Tokugawa shogunate was better for Japan than it would have been otherwise, well, there are good things about the Tokugawa shogunate and there are bad things about it. Mm-hmm. Clearly, he's a great general. You know, it's like Julius Caesar is a great general, but were they right to assassinate him? Was he going to take over Rome? Was he going to end the Republic? Right. These are the, you know, we can't answer these questions. When you look at the great men of history, and Tokugawa certainly is one of the great men of history, they always are going to come with a bunch of baggage, you know?
Yeah. That's for sure. What about the decision here? Let me ask you about two more things. What about the decision here for him to tell Mariko what her father was actually doing, waiting this long to tell Mariko and to be like, you didn't know? It seemed to be a bit convenient for him to say you didn't
know. That's what I thought too.
Yeah, what did you think about this situation here? Is that different from the book?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, so first of all, I don't think there's anything in the book about Torunaga setting up this guy to kill Garota. I don't think maybe there is. I mean, it's a 1200 page book or something. So you even reading it 7 or 8, 10 times as I have, you still can miss stuff. So maybe there's something in there about it. I love that idea. And what I love even more is because now I'm going, look, whose idea was it that she married Buntaro? Right. Based on this, I think it's Torunaga's idea.
Torunaga,
I think he's been playing
her father into interesting.
I think Torunaga's been playing this game for a long, long time. Well, that's his whole character, is to wait and move the chess pieces slowly but surely until he gets in the situation he wants to be in. You know, I think it's really, really interesting to set it up this way. And I don't know where it's going to go, except for the fact that the other thing about this episode, and I really like the way you structured our conversation.
Yeah,
this episode is about two women.
Yes,
that's what this whole episode is about. It is setting up like, oh, you think that the big conflict is Torunaga and Blackthorne, Yabushige and Umi against Ishido and all his people? No, the actual big conflict is between Ochiba and Mariko.
Yep.
And I know what happens, what all the things that Mariko does in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I have a feeling she's going to do some other stuff that's going to be different based on the way they're setting things up, which is really cool.
Yeah. They've made a point of stressing that she can fight. So yeah. I wonder what that's going to lead to. Even in this episode, in the flashback, she is training to fight, and Ochiba is watching this and watching her fight and watching her do what she's doing. So clearly she knows what a formidable warrior Mariko might possibly be. So this is another element of this. And as I said earlier, I love that, as you were just pointing out, two women popping up now out of nowhere in the sixth episode. And I don't mean out of nowhere like we hadn't seen them. I mean, where we had been bought into the fact that this is male versus male. These are the two women who are coming in who are the impetus for what happened, or around the impetus for what's going on now. So I think that's going to be fascinating to see this play out. One last thing here. Let me ask you about Crimson Sky. How is that different than what we see in the book, or is it pretty much the same? Because it seems to me like Torunaga, yet again, is manipulating the whole situation, kind of like Mark Anthony, right? Does with Mark Anthony with Caesar, right? But they are great men. They are good men. So, but don't vote for me. I don't want to be in power. I just think those other people shouldn't be in power. But it seems like he uses the Sugiyama death at Ishido's hands as the reason to go for Crimson Sky when he had denied wanting to do it, and now quickly jumps onto it and is on board with it. So How is that different from the book, and how do you think it worked here in this particular episode?
Here's what I'll say. And I don't know exactly where this is going to go, because there are many things that are set up slightly differently in the way we got here.
Right.
Crimson Sky, definitely in the book. Definitely a lot of talk about it in the book. Torunaga is, and most of his advisors are all over the place on whether or not it's completely hopeless. Some of them are just like, I want to fight. You know, Buntaro's like, let's fight. You know, like that's the solution to all the problems.
That's his thing, yeah.
You know, but what I will say is that, as I said at the very beginning of this episode, Torunaga likes to perform in no dramas as an actor. So what he's actually planning on doing,
yeah,
I don't think we know. He did say we're going to do Crimson Sky. Is that what he's going to do? I don't know.
That's a great point. That's a great point. Yeah, and I like that that's an element of the show that is so... I like that that's such a predominant element of the show that you don't know what Torunaga is going to do. And even if people like you who've read the book multiple times are in a state of like, well, I really don't know what he's going to do, that makes it even more exciting that they've adapted this correctly in a way that that includes book readers as well as people who haven't read the book into the drama and includes them in that place of being in the unknown, which is what excites viewers when they're into a show like this. So certainly that's a massive positive about this particular adaptation, and everyone involved with the adaptation deserves so much credit for that. All right, so is there anything else we should hit on? I feel like we talked about everything. Steve, anything I missed that you want to make sure we talk about before we wrap up this review?
Just one quick thing about Mariko that occurred to me as you were talking about her before, and we definitely see her fighting, which is really cool, and maybe we'll see that again, but it is the scene, which I think was in the second episode, where everyone is speculating about why Torunaga is doing what he's doing and what his plan, and the only person who knows, who totally gets it, is Mariko. Is that's intellectual. I think that's super important, is that the only person who seems to be at Torunaga's level is her, and right. He knows it. So all of the questions of why did he send her in with the Anjin-san? What is he doing? What is his plan? How is she going to fit in? That's a piece of it. And I don't know exactly what it's going to be. I certainly know some things that I think are going to happen. Right. And by the way, the one other thing, the big thing that I was talking about,
yeah,
still hasn't happened.
I was just going to say.
And I was so focused on it that I actually went and found a message board where people are going like, when is this going to happen? And it's been a message board for like 3 weeks of people saying, well, it's got to be next episode. They can't cut it out. Well, maybe they'll happen this. Oh, I bet they're setting it up for it now. I like that they moved it after this. And it's just like, you know, a Reddit thread that goes on forever. So I'm not the only one. I feel that we're running out of time. And to have this moment happen, and it's really important. So I really hope they don't cut it out. At this point, I'm like 50-50. It might not be in the show at all.
Wow. And we have two episodes left. So
is it just two left?
Yeah, just two more left, 7 and 8. So
shit.
Yeah, that could be real interesting how they're gonna slide that in. At least as I'm looking at it here, right? All episodes.
I thought it was gonna be 10.
Let me see. Let me take a look here, real quick. 7, 8. 9. Oh, there is 10. Sorry about that. We got 4 episodes left. My apologies.
I was going to say, that's a lot. We got a lot to wrap up in 2 episodes.
Yeah, I clearly didn't go all the way down on IMDb. Yeah. So you've got us for at least another month reviewing this show. All right, well, there you go. That's our spoiler review here for episode 6 of Shogun on FX, on Hulu. Thank you to everyone who's been enjoying our reviews here posting your comments down below and sharing them on social media. That is super important, guys. If you want to get more and more people to watch these reviews, you really like these reviews, sharing it on your social media really matters. Putting a link, telling people that you're excited about this, because even if you've got 5 followers or 50,000 followers, those people might give it a chance because you are giving your stamp of approval on our reviews. And Steve and I both appreciate everyone who's been sharing them already. But if you haven't shared them and you want to share them, get more people, we would both appreciate that very much because we're enjoying doing these reviews. And we think, I will say this, I'll speak for Steve when I say this, I think we're doing a damn good job on these reviews, and we'd like more people to watch them and enjoy them and enjoy the show with us as well. Steve, thanks again, brother. Please let people know where they can find you and where they can find us on the Cinephiles.
So SR Morris on Twitter, SR Morris 1 on Instagram, the Cinephiles podcast, that's CINE-FILES, where we do seriously, ridiculously deep dives into great films. And so we just did 3 parts on Goodfellas, 3 parts on Raging Bull. We go, if you want to know everything you need to know about movies and go beat by beat through them and see how they work, I think we do the best job there is on the internets. And we also do our live shows, and those are not quite such deep dives, often much more fun. And we just did one on Back to School, the classic 1986 Rodney Dangerfield film that was a hoot and a half. I believe that is the technical term for that conversation. I had a ball. And if you want to support the Cinephiles, you can do it at patreon.com/thecinephiles or subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and get all sorts of bonus features and ad-free versions of the show. I think that's all the stuff.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You nailed it all. And as I said earlier, if you want to listen to any of these episodes, say you stumbled upon us, you don't want to go back and watch us on YouTube, you can listen to the audio of each one of these episodes on the Cinephiles podcast feed for Shogun. So go and subscribe there as well. And as for me, at The Roka Says on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, please subscribe to the channel down below. We're marching towards 50,000 subscribers. Come aboard and join our army as we march to 50,000 subscribers. Would love to have you come aboard. And my Patreon, patreon.com/John Roka, that is now revving back up again after taking a little bit of a break. We are back into hanging out every week on the Discord. So go and join that and all the other benefits that you'll be getting throughout the month. But thank you guys so much. Enjoy yourselves. Come back and join us next week for another spoiler review of Shogun. And we'll talk to, for Steve Morris, I'm the Outlaw John Roka. And we'll talk to you next time with another brand new one of these here on the Outlaw Nation. Peace. Until then.